Today in our Great Questions series, we come to a great question from the book of Job. I've always loved this question. It's very meaningful and it's so appropriate. I was reading a couple months ago, a journalist had secretly interviewed some people who work for Facebook in their content monitoring. So if you can imagine, these people are looking at questionable videos and pictures that are being posted, and they have to decide, yes, it stays, or no, it's deleted. And they do this all day, every day. This one young lady was in her training period. They get 4 weeks of training. It was taking place in Phoenix, and there are 1,000 people in this department. And we're calling her Chloe. That's not her real name because you're not allowed to use your real name in that line of work. And Chloe is supposed to do a presentation. 3.5 weeks into her training, she goes before the class. There's a video that she's going to hit the play button on. She's never seen it before. She has to say in front of the class whether that video is a no or a go. And so she hits the video, and the video starts to play, and it's a horrific murder, you know, an actual footage of somebody being murdered in connection with a drug cartel. It's a terrible thing to watch, and she's saying that she understands, according to Rule 13 of the code that they provided, no murder can ever be posted on Facebook or Instagram, so it's a no-go. And as she's describing what was wrong with the video, all of a sudden her voice starts to shake, and she trembles, and it's done. She sits down, but as she sits down, she's very emotional about what she's just seen. The next person goes up and hits the play button on their video and describes what's wrong, but Chloe isn't doing real well, and so she has to dismiss herself, exit the room. She goes to the break room, and she's crying. And she can't stop crying, and she's trembling. She goes to the restroom, and she cries in there for a little while, and she still is having trouble gaining her composure. Finally, she thinks, I have got to get back to my training, or I could lose this job. And she's making $15 an hour, $28,000 a year. She doesn't want to lose her job. She goes back to class, and as soon as she gets there, the other student who's presenting his video is showing a simulated drone attack with dead bodies falling all around. And once again, she can't stand it. She gets up and she excuses herself and she's crying in the restroom. One of the supervisors comes in and gives her a weak hug. Arrangements are made for the on-site counselor to talk to her. And the counselor says, you've had a panic attack. Chloe sticks out the job for another 12 months and then she quits. And most people quit at about 12 months. It's just very upsetting. And she realized that she was giving her speech that day that this was not good, this was not right. People in her line of work will look at between 200 and 400 videos or pictures every single day at work. If they fall below 200, they will have a problem with their employment. And so she's looking at 200 to 400 videos or pictures at work, and every one of those has something that's rude or mean or pornographic or violent, and she just couldn't take it. It wasn't the right job. And she realized that she was talking that day, what I'm saying, you know, I want this job and everything. It's not me. It's not right for me. I am not going to do this. And she did it for a time and she left. Job asked the question, how have you plentifully declared the thing as it is? I love that. It's in a group of questions. Just notice his helpers, his friends have not been helpful at all. Job said to them, how have you guys helped me, the guy, without power? And how are you saving the arm that has no strength? You know, I'm dying over here. How are you helping me? And how have you counseled him that has no wisdom? You know, I need a little help here, and you're not helping at all. And then this one underlined, this is the big one for today. And how have you plentifully declared the thing as it is, as it really is? And to whom have you uttered words? Who are you talking to? And whose spirit came from you when you said these things? You're just not helping me at all. And that question, how have you plentifully declared the thing as it is? Kyle and Dalich, who are really important linguists and Old Testament scholars, have said, how have you fully declared the essence of the matter? Some new versions won't have it just like this. How have you declared the thing as it is? They'll say wisdom, and that's okay. But this is better. How have you thoroughly declared the thing as it really is? And that's a great question. Joseph Benson, when he was elaborating on this said, how have you given the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth? And that's the question. And as we look at that question today, I want to just sort of explore what's happening in our own lives. How are we really seeing things as they are and saying it as it really is? And the question is that how it really is, or am I making up an excuse? Am I mistaken? Is that what other people want me to say? Am I just saying that because it's for my own self-interest? How have you abundantly, over and over throughout your life, how have you said it as it really is? As it really is. The essence, the truth. How have you done? And hopefully the answer is, I'm doing very well. Thank you very much. Is that how it really is, or am I just mistaken? The problem with Job's friends is they were spouting off a lot of theology, and they were so wrong. They were so wrong. At the end of the book, when the Lord is addressing what they said, addressing to Job, he says, after the Lord has spoken these words to Job, then the Lord said to Eliphaz, Job's friend, my wrath, my anger is kindled against you and against your two friends, for you have not spoken of me the thing that is right, as my servant Job has. You have not spoken the thing that is right. Just like the question, how have you diligently spoken the thing as it is? And the Lord says, not real well. So these friends have spouted off a lot of theology. They had a lot of opinions, a lot of dogmatism, but they were in error. And it's so easy to be in error and still spout off. The question is, how have you abundantly spoken the thing as it really is? And that's what we need to know. Hermann Göring was the second in command of the Nazi regime during World War II. And he was talking about propaganda. You know, if you're trying to give somebody information, that's called education. And it's supposed to be journalism. It's all about the information. But if you're just trying to persuade someone, you might want to leave certain information out. That's called propaganda or advertising. And Hermann Göring, he says, naturally, the common people don't want war. All you have to do is tell them they're being attacked. It's not true, but tell them that. Tell them that they're being attacked and denounce the pacifists for lack of patriotism and exposing the country to danger. It works the same way in any country. So you see, it's propaganda. We're not telling them the truth. We're not giving them the information they really need. We are persuading them, not informing them. And sometimes, if you're persuading people, it's good not to inform them. And so, is it information that we're acting on, or have we been persuaded mistakenly? How have you plentifully declared the thing as it really is, and not just acted out of lack of information, misinformation? Is that how it really is, or am I just mistaken? I mean, is it true what they're telling me, and what are they telling me? Well, they're telling me that there's no evidence for intelligent design in this world. They're telling me that Christianity is one of the greatest sources of oppression in this world. They're telling me that low self-esteem is the real problem for my psychological unwellness. They're telling me there's no difference between males and females, or oppositely, that there's a huge difference between males and females, and biological males can think and act like females if they want to. They're telling me that single motherhood is equal to the traditional family, and they're telling me that abortion is a constitutional right. Is that true? Because that's what I'm hearing. Is that based on the information, or was that all just persuasion? Which is it? Because I want to plentifully declare the thing as it really is, and not just spout off a lot of things that aren't true. Which is it? Am I mistaken? Back in 1981, the Museum of Natural History in Britain was celebrating its 100-year anniversary. When you walked in, there was an exhibit on evolution, and this was the sign that was on the exhibit in 1981. It was displayed prominently. Have you ever wondered why there are so many different kinds of living things? One idea is that all the living things we see today have evolved from a distant ancestor by a process of gradual change. How could evolution have occurred? How could one species change into another? The exhibition in this hall looks at one possible explanation, the explanation of Charles Darwin. There was another plaque just over in the same room, and it said, another view is that God created all living things perfect and unchanging. When the sign and the museum said, Well, one possibility is Darwinism. This ignited a firestorm. Oh, no. The scientific community really lost it on this one. And Nature, the most important scientific journal in biology and evolutionary thought, wrote an article, an editorial, with these words. Can it be that the managers of the museum, which is the nearest thing to a citadel of Darwinism, have lost their nerve, not to mention their good sense? Most of the museum's biologists would rather lose their right hands than begin a sentence with the phrase, if the theory of evolution is true. Like, you can't say if it's true. You have to tell everybody it is absolutely true. No equivocation. And to do that was like heresy to our religion, a citadel of Darwinism. And so after tremendous pressure, the museum took the sign away and just said, yeah, it's all true and there's no question to it. Information or just persuasion? A great article appeared in year 2000 in the Ledger newspaper, and George Kaler, the journalist, was introducing a microbiologist, interviewing him, and the microbiologist did not want his name mentioned because this was going to be trouble. So the interviewer says, do you believe, oh, and a microbiologist is a pretty smart guy, right? Do you believe that genetic information evolved? And the microbiologist says, nobody I know believes it evolved. It was engineered by a genius beyond genius, and such information could not have been written any other way. The paper and ink did not write the book. Knowing what we know, it is ridiculous to think otherwise. And the interviewer says, well, have you ever stated that in a public lecture or in public writings? And the molecular biologist says, no, I just say it evolved. All government work, research, grants, papers, big college lectures, everything would stop. I'd be out of a job or relegated to the outer fringes where I couldn't earn a decent living. And the interviewer says, I hate to say it, but that sounds intellectually dishonest. And the molecular biologist says, creation design is like an elephant in the living room. It moves around. It takes up an enormous amount of space. It loudly trumpets, bumps into us, knocks things over, eats a ton of hay, and smells like an elephant. And yet we have to swear it isn't there. So is it information or is it just persuasion, propaganda? We can be so easily mistaken. And we have to ask ourselves, is that how it really is? Am I plentifully declaring the thing as it really is? Or am I just spouting off bad theology, bad science, whatever? Because in the Christian faith, it's really important that you say it like it really is. Well, of course, we have to ask ourselves, is that how it really is, or is that just an excuse? Because it's really easy to make up excuses. Remember Jesus' parable of the Great Supper? He says, a certain man makes a great supper, and he invites the guests, and then all the guests begin to make excuses. One says, well, I just bought a piece of real estate, and I have to go check it out. So I pray thee, have me excused. I can't come. Sorry, can't come. Excuse me. And then another one says, well, I just bought this group of farm animals, oxen, and I have to go test them and see if they can really pull the plow well. So please have me excused. Another one says, well, I just got married, so I can't really come to your supper. So, you know, I can't come. Please have me excused. And everybody makes an excuse. Excuses are a really big problem. Sociologists Bradley Campbell and Jason Manning have been talking about this, and they were talking about the difference in today's culture compared to the way things were in the 1800s and 1900s. This is going to be so helpful in understanding the things that puzzle you about our current cultural milieu. They were saying that in the 1800s, 1900s, in the Western world, so, you know, United States, Britain, the European countries that have followed along those Western cultures, this is what our culture was. Low sensitivity to slights. We taught our children, sticks and stones will break your bones, but names will never hurt you, so get over it. Don't be so thin-skinned. We were tolerant of insult and disagreement. We frowned on being thin-skinned, like, oh, don't be so thin-skinned, you know, toughen up. Actual violence, well, that was supposed to be confronted by the authorities, not personal revenge. So, oh, hey, you know, you hurt me, now I'm going to beat you half to death with this baseball bat. It's like, no, you call the police. All right, virtue, well, virtue, that was considered to be restrained prudent and quiet self-assurance. You know, that's what a great person is. And insults, well, if somebody insults you, you discuss it directly with them, or better yet, just ignore it. You know, so it's an insult. Just ignore it. And then for intentional insults, like if I would intentionally insult your intelligence, or if I would insult your appearance, I say, well, that's just uncivil. You know, we don't act like that. Well, of course, all of that is very New Testament. Children have to be taught not to do those things. And the New Testament teaches its followers not to do those things. So all of that's tangled up, welded together with the New Testament ethics. You turn the other cheek, you know. If somebody insults you, you don't insult him back. And even if he kind of hurts you, you don't hurt him back. We just don't. Peter says, not returning insult for insult, but oppositely, blessing. Oh, you said something mean to me. I'm going to say something nice to you. I mean, that's New Testament. We have to teach our children to do these things because it's not hardwired into us. It's not intuitive. It has to be taught. Bless them that curse you. Do good to them that hate you. Oh, you're mean to me. I'm going to be good to you. You have to teach children this. It's hard. You have to teach yourself this. It's hard. Romans 12:18. As much as lies in you, live peaceably with all people. You have to be a peacemaker. Blessed are the peacemakers. Seek peace and pursue it. That's the New Testament. You have to teach this to children. They don't naturally do it. Avenge not yourselves. Oh, well, you know, this guy was going to be mean to you, so you're going to be mean to him back. Like, he threw garbage in your yard, so you take your garbage can and empty it in his yard. We don't do that. We don't do that. That's not right. We learned that from the New Testament. A soft answer turns away wrath. Oh, this guy is like in your face saying profanities. Well, we teach our children, you don't just get in his face and say profanities back. A soft answer can defuse the situation. That's what we need to do. You teach this. Do all things without complaining and disputing. Like, don't run around here grumbling and complaining. Just stop it. You know, you sound like a little baby. Don't do that. And don't argue. You know, kids, stop arguing. We don't argue. And so you teach people that. That's New Testament. That's what it means to be a Christian. That, our sociologist friends say, was what was defining Western culture. So all of these things, low sensitivity to slights, tolerant of insults and disagreement, violence is to be handled by other people. You don't get violent yourself. To be virtuous is to be restrained and quiet. And insults, you just talk to the person individually about what he said. You know, that hurt my feelings. I hope you won't say that anymore. Or skip it all together. And, of course, you never would do that yourself. That was the Western culture, the United States, Britain, Western Europe in the 1800s and 1900s. That's what we were holding up as the right way to live. Now, these people, as far as I know, are not Christians who are saying this. They're observing the culture. Well, now, the same sociologists are describing our current cultural milieu. Now there's high sensitivity to slights, even if they're only perceived and not actual. Like, I think you don't like me. Dependence on others to assist and protect from slights. You have to help me because I'm vulnerable. My feelings are hurt. You have to do something about my hurt feelings. Status and deference are today gained by appeals to personal frailty and vulnerability. I have to have preferential treatment because I'm wounded. I have to have preferential treatment because I'm small. I hurt, so you have to take care of me. Victimization is both the highest sin, if you're the one victimizing someone else, that is the very worst thing you can do. And victimization is also the highest virtue. You have to honor me because I have been victimized. You have to give me first place because I'm a victim. Reward you gain by public, hostile, and frequent complaints. Like, I will tattle. I will go on social media and I will say this loudly. I will march. I will carry signs. I will protest. I will be as noisy as I can possibly be because I have been slighted. There is a unidirectional nature of microaggressions and cultural appropriations. That is, I'm a victim, so if I get rude to you, you deserve it. But you better not get rude to me. Don't even look like you're being rude to me, but I might be very rude to you. It's one way. And then now there's the new phenomenon called competitive victimhood. you have to take care of me because I'm a female. Or yes, well, you have to take care of me because I'm a gay female. Well, you have to take care of me even more than that because I am a black gay female. And so you compete. Who is the most victimized? Whoever wins has the status and the preferential treatment. This is our culture today. You know that's an excuse, right? You can't live like this. And we excuse our complaining when the Lord says, do all things without murmurings and disputings. Don't be a complainer. And we excuse our bitterness and our harsh answers when the Lord says, no, 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 you must live peaceably. You do not retaliate. That's not what we do. And so we have excuses. But I have to retaliate. I have to complain. Like, no, you don't have to. That's an excuse. And of course, it trickles down into the church. John Piper is so good along these lines. He says, emotional blackmail happens when a person equates his or her emotional pain with another person's failure to love. Like, I'm offended. You said something that disturbed me. That means you don't love. That means you're a failure because I'm offended. You disturbed me. You have failed. Emotional blackmail says, if I feel hurt by you, you are guilty. And there is no defense. The hurt person has become judge and jury. Truth does not matter. This emotional device is a great evil. So you see, yes, you told me that what I was doing was foolish. That disturbs me. That's a lack of love. And you owe me an apology. Like, well, I have to tell you that what you were doing biblically was very unwise. That disturbs me. You owe me an apology. You said that what I'm doing is immoral. That disturbs me. Now you owe me an apology. And of course, it might truly be foolish or immoral. And you know, the Bible talks about truth and love, truth and grace. And we talk about that. You saw embedded in the motto that we had here at the church for decades, conservative Christianity, that was supposed to be the truth part, in a spirit of grace, that was supposed to be the love part. And you've seen my list of truth and grace texts all through the scriptures, truth and grace. Now, if I have told you something that is true, and I have told you something with your very best interests at heart, then it was also loving. And if that disturbs you, I haven't failed you. Faithful are the wounds of a friend. It wounded you, but those were faithful wounds. And you should consider them to be faithful wounds. But now today, no, that disturbs me, so you owe me an apology. And that's a really big problem. Of course, that's an excuse. If it disturbs you when somebody calls you out for your foolishness or your immorality, the real solution is to change your behavior, not to be upset and disturbed at the person who was trying to be your faithful friend. They say, I'm too busy. You know, that's an excuse. Is that the way it really is, or is that what we say? I'm too busy is like the nuclear option to excuse anything that you don't want to do. I'm too busy. And of course, the twin to that is, I don't have the money to do it. So I just wanted to do a little time budget with you for just a moment. What does that mean when we say, I'm too busy? Here we go. In blue, you're going to talk about 76% of your time in life, and this is true for all of us. We all do this. And there are 168 hours in a week, so in blue, we're going to account for everything but 40 hours in your week. So this is what we all do as adults. There's going to be sleeping 7 hours per night. Now, you can fudge on that if you want to, but you might get sick. So let's say 7 hours a night. That's what you should be doing. That's going to be 50 hours a week. Eating, even if you're fast, I think you're going to spend 2 hours a day eating and preparing your food. Especially if you like to eat in a healthy way, it's going to take you a little longer to prepare your food, and you have to clean up when you're done. So I think you're going to spend about 2 hours eating, even if you're tight. You're going to have to go fast to get all your food things done in 2 hours. Hygiene. You're going to spend about 1 hour a day taking a shower, doing your laundry, shave, makeup, hair, teeth. I think you're going to have to spend an hour. That's pretty tight, and probably You know, you could spend longer than that if you're not careful, but I think you're going to have to do that. And that includes sometimes you have to go to the barber shop. That takes a whole hour right there. Then you have your house and yard. We might include car here. And I think you're going to have to spend about 1 hour a day cleaning your house. You're going to have to pick up after yourself. You're going to have to clean the toilet from time to time. You're going to have to do laundry, linen. You're going to have to do, you know, your desk is a little out of hand right now. Your laundry room, like, sheesh, what happened in here? Your closet, your attic, your garage, your garden shed. And isn't your car about ready for some vacuuming, a little cleaning around here? I think even if you're tight, it's going to be about an hour a day getting your grass mowed, your house clean enough, your car clean enough. I think it's going to take you about an hour a day. And then you have an occupation. You say, well, I work full-time 40 hours. But nobody who works white-collar jobs is working 40 hours anymore. If you go literally from 9 to 5, you'll probably get fired. White-collar jobs are going to expect more than that. If you're an entrepreneur and you want to start your own business, forget about it. You're not even in the ballpark for 40 hours a week. You're way over that. And if you are in the military, forget about it. You're indentured servant to the military. And if you are going to commute back and forth any distance, then you're running up a lot of hours there. So I'm saying this is pretty tight, and you're still talking about 128 out of 168 hours every week. That's pretty tight. That means you have 40 hours left. And in the red there, you see some of the things that happen in this 40 hours. It's going to be worship and family and friends and charity and other learning that you want to do and decompression and pets and bills and paperwork and emergencies and repairs and shopping and hobbies. Now, this brings us to the subject of the 10,000-hour rule. The 10,000-hour rule says if you spend 10,000 hours on anything, you're going to be among the very best at it. So, for example, if you spend 20 hours a week for 10 years on playing the violin, you're going to be a pretty good violin player. That's going to put you in the upper echelon of violin musicians on planet Earth. The 10,000-hour rule. And you can do that with anything. You can do that with practicing the yo-yo. I mean, you could be great if you do 20 hours a week for 10 years. Skateboarding, like, I'd like to be able to do that. You could. 20 hours a week, 10 years, you'd be a great skateboarder. It puts you at the very elite, normally, the very elite fraction of people around you. And what's weird about America is that we are always very, very competitive. We're very competitive. So we look over at that guy and think, you know what's great about him? He speaks three languages. I wish I could speak three languages. That'd be great. I think I want to do that. Or that guy just got another degree. Or that guy's a marathoner. Or that guy over there, he can rebuild and renovate his whole house. And that guy over there, you know what he does? He builds wooden kayaks in his basement. I mean, they're beautiful. I want to do that. And all these things that people do, and you think, I want to do that. Well, here's the trouble. You only can do that with so many things in your life. To break down our budget a little further, we only have 40 hours left. And in case you're not doing the math, that's not quite 6 hours a day. So in that other day time, what do you want to do? Let's say we want to really live for Jesus. All right, let's try it, shall we? And let's be tight. How about personal worship? Don't you think it'd be a good idea if you really wanted to follow Jesus to spend like 30 minutes a day in personal worship? That'd be your prayer time, your Bible reading time, and the other things you read and listen to for your walk with the Lord. I think that sounds good, right? That's going to be 3.5 hours a week. Church involvement. If you're really going to do this right, you're probably going to have to spend like 4 hours a week in church. That's going to include, like, if you come to Sunday school and this worship service, you're already going to be here like 2.5 hours if I go overtime, worse than that. And then you have the commute time. Some of you came some distance to be here. And then if you want to do one more thing, some small group gathering, something you're volunteering for, then it's another trip out to the church, another hour or so. And you're going to be 4 hours a week. And that's pretty tight, you know. You could easily do more than that. And how about if you're married, you think, well, I really think I ought to spend like 30 minutes with my wife or my husband. I mean, if I really want a tight relationship, it just seems like we're We're going to have to pull up the chairs and talk. Maybe we'll listen to music. We'll sit by the fireplace. We'll go for a walk. We'll go for a bike ride. And not long, you know, just like 30 minutes a day. Is that asking too much? And we might snuggle a little bit, you know. And who knows what great stuff could happen after that. So do you suppose 30 minutes is asking too much, just 30 minutes? And of course, if you go on a date on Friday night, you go from, say, 7 to 10, dinner and a movie, now you're way longer than that on that particular day. So can we at least say to have a happy marriage, that's going to take you like 30 minutes a day, even if you're tight, you know? And what about children? Well, there's bedtime ritual and bath time ritual. That's going to take a little while. And the poor kids, you got to play with them, and sometimes you have to help them with their homework. I mean, it'd be tight, right? Can you give your kids 30 minutes? I mean, maybe if you have four kids, you give all four of them 7.5 minutes. I mean, can we do that? I mean, that's not too extravagant, right? We got to give them that. And then friends. I mean, at least 20 minutes a day. Can we just do that? We're talking over the back fence. We're calling on the telephone. Hey, how you doing? Yeah, nothing really big, right? Just 20 minutes. Can we not just take 20 minutes a day for friendship? Are we asking too much there? And then, so that's pretty tight. And then bills and paperwork, 15 minutes a day. Like, oh, I have to pay these bills. And I got put on hold for 15 minutes trying to get this credit card thing figured out. And then I tried to install this app for 15 minutes. That's my whole day there. And I got to go to the DMV and I have to go get something over there at the post office. And I mean, 15 minutes, that's tight, right? And you look at the stack of stuff on my desk and you're like, ah, someday I'm going to have to address this. That's not 15 minutes. So surely 15 minutes, that's fair, right? I mean, you have to do that as an adult. And then shopping, you're going to shop probably 90 minutes a week. I mean, you don't just go to one grocery store. You go to this grocery store to get your meat and that grocery store to get your organics and whatever. And then there's not just the grocery store. You got to get something from the parts store. You have to go to the gas station, get something from the gas station. And so shopping an hour and a half a week, I mean, that's very reasonable, right? Well, you just lost 20 hours. That's it, 20 hours. You know what you have now? You have 20 hours left in your week. Now, let me tell you how you can get ahead, how you can earn your next degree, how you can learn another language, how you can master the musical instrument, how you become a crack marathoner. You know what you do? You just eliminate that top one, personal worship. Let's get rid of that. And church involvement, let's get rid of that. And let's neglect our spouses. And let's neglect our children. And let's neglect our friends. And that's how I just picked up a new language. Isn't that great? So Jesus says, take up your cross and follow me. So I'd love to, Lord, but I'm too busy. Now there are 20 hours left at the bottom of that. You can't see that very well, but that says you have 20 hours left and here's what you can do with it. That's 2.5 hours per day. By the way, for a lot of you, that's going to mean something like 8 o'clock at night to 10:30, because those are the hours, right? So what are you going to do from 8 o'clock at night to 10:30? Here are what you might want to do. Suggestions. That would be your educational goals. I'm going to take a course. Your learning, your skills. I am going to learn how to do a kickflip on a skateboard. Those are your pets, your hobbies, your projects around the house, projects around the garage, projects woodworking, whatever you do. Emergencies for friends. Oh, yeah, you know, my elderly parents, they want me to pick up the car and take it to the shop for them. So, okay. And then you have repairs of your own, and you have screen time, and your friends need help moving. And so, you know what? Let me just speak generally. For the most part, we don't want to quit our hobbies, our projects, our screen time. So if you're smart, you cut out those top ones. It's personal worship, church involvement. And you know what? All that is invisible. Everyone will look at you and say, you are the person I want to be because you know more than one language. You're the person I want to be because you're a marathoner. I mean, you have a black belt. You are in UFC. You are able to completely design your own website. You are the man. I want to be you. And so you could take away all of those top ones. You still have to pay your bills. You're going to be stuck with that. But you take away all those top ones and no one would say boo to you. They will never know. And the Lord says, take up your cross and follow me. And you say, can't, Lord, too busy. Of course, the same thing could have been done with money, right? Is that the way it really is? Or is that just what others want me to say? You know about this? This was the Ash Conformity Experiment. done in the 50s and repeated in a variety of ways ever since. You have seven actors in a room with one real participant. And you tell the actors, here's what we're going to do. We're going to bring our real participant in here. And we're going to ask him, which line on the right is the same length as the line on the left? And you seven actors are going to, we answer out loud, you seven actors are going to say, oh, definitely, I think that middle line there is the same as the card on the left. And then this participant is going to listen to you, and he's going to be scratching his head like, what am I missing here? Because all these guys think that the middle line is the same as the one on the left, and am I just stark raving mad, or I'm not going to sit here and disagree with everybody. And so one third of the time, the participants would say, you're right. That middle line is the same as the one on the left. And plain as the nose on your face, it is not. That is peer pressure. I cannot disagree with seven other people, and I'm not going to be a monkey here to be laughed at. So if they say they're the same, then they're the same, and I'm just going to have to go get my eyes checked or something, okay? And so one third of the time, the people said the wrong answer, and they knew perfectly well what the right answer was. Is that the way it really is? How have you plentifully declared the thing as it is, as it really is, and not just done what the other people wanted you to do, say what the other people wanted you to say? A group of women who were taking a French class together decided to go out after the class was over and have dinner. They were talking around the table, and one of the ladies, a more sophisticated lady, she said, how many of you have been faithful to your husbands for your whole marriage? So 12 ladies there, one is the asker. 11 hands could have been raised, only one was. One lady says, I've been faithful to my husband for my whole marriage. Now the lady that I'm speaking about in question went home and she told her husband that story. They ask us all, how many of you have been faithful to your husbands? And only one lady raised her hand, and honey, I was not the one lady who raised her hand. And he was mortified. He was crestfallen. But she said, no. But I have been faithful to you all of our marriage. And he said, well, why didn't you raise your hand? He said, because I was ashamed. I would look like a goody two-shoes. How have you plentifully declared the thing as it really is, and not just what other people want you to say? It's so hard to do that. John 12, many believed on him, but because of the Pharisees, they did not confess him, lest they should be put out of the synagogue, for they loved the praise of men more than the praise of God. In Isaiah's day, this is a rebellious nation, lying children, children that will not hear the law of the Lord, who say to the seers, you know, the visionary prophets, don't look, don't see, and to the prophets, do not prophesy to us right things, speak to us smooth words, tell us the things that we want to hear. And so that's always the temptation. At a Benny Hinn event, faith healing event, one man confessed that when Benny Hinn touched him, he just faked a fall. And he apologized to the cameraman. He said, I'm sorry for faking it. The cameraman says, oh, a lot of people fake it. It's okay. Jamie Buckingham wrote an article on Catherine Coleman. Same thing. He loved her. She was a faith healer. She touched him. And, you know, there was nothing to it. But he said, I loved her too much to disappoint her. So with a sign of resignation, I fell backwards into the arms of the man behind me. How have you plentifully declared the thing as it is, as it really is, and not just as other people wanted you to say it? Is this what serves my own self-interest, or is this the way it really is? They speak great swelling words of worthless value. Words, words, words. They allure through sin. While they promise them liberty, they themselves are the slaves of corruption. They that do these things aren't serving our Lord Jesus Christ, but their own belly, creature comforts. You know, it feeds me better. And by good words and fair speeches, they deceive the hearts of the simple. Is that how it really is? Or are you just looking out for your own best interests? Aldous Huxley is the agnostic who invented the term agnostic. He said, I have motives for not wanting the world to have meaning. We don't know because we don't want to know. The philosophy of meaningless was essentially an instrument of liberation. We objected to the morality because it interfered with our sexual freedom. So, Mr. Huxley, why don't you believe in God? It's very inconvenient to believe in God. If there's God, then I can't do what I want to do. So we don't know that there's a God because we don't want to know. Thomas Nagel, professor of philosophy, New York University. I speak from experience. Being strongly subject to this fear myself, I want atheism to be true. And I'm made uneasy by the fact that some of the most intelligent and well-informed people I know are religious believers. It isn't just that I don't believe in God and naturally hope that I'm right in my belief. It's that I hope there is no God. I don't want there to be a God. I don't want the universe to be like that. So it's a big question. How have you plentifully declared the thing as it is, as it really is, the essence of the matter, the whole truth of the matter? How have you done that? Are you doing that now with all these issues in your life? Or are you making mistakes because you won't inform yourself? Or you're making an excuse? Or others want you to say something different? Or it just serves your own best interests?